And good morning, everyone. That distinctive music, of course, means that it's the Walt Bodine Show here on KCUR-FM. And it's a Friday. And it's a third Friday, so that means it's the Movie Critics Day. And I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. And we're going to be talking about movies that have opened over the last 3 weeks or so. And today I'm joined by...
Good morning, it's Marie Asner with the Metro Voice News, PhantomTollbooth.org, and OnAirPrep.com.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas, and I used to be on the late lamented KXTR Radio Bach.
Oh, that is a sad story.
Oh, yes.
Really sad. And tragic and unforgivable, actually.
Well, there's been a lot of action going on in the movie theaters, and of course the big title of the day, and big title probably for the year, is The Hunger Games, the adaptation of Suzanne Collins' hit trilogy for young people, and it's a story about a dystopian future, and I'm telling you, this movie is going to be huge. So, John, why don't you start us off telling us a little bit about The Hunger Games?
But first indicating that whatever we say won't matter anyway.
Yes.
However, I think we're all generally positive about it. Certainly I was, and fans of the books, the first book in this case, will be delighted to see that some of their favorite scenes are still included here, such as, can you spell... she's up in the tree with a hive of angry hornets. those of you that read it certainly know what I mean. I do have some quibbles, though. One of them is, I don't know if it's adequately explained here, at least, what the deal is with the Capitol, why it exists at all, why it is allowed to exist. And, of course, as you read the books, you understand a lot more why it should not exist. But you've got the Capitol, those are the rich fat cats, and then you've got the have-nots in the 12 districts. And, oh, yes, there's that 13th district, which isn't really mentioned yet, but watch out for that one. And you've got Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss and the two young men in her life who are both introduced here. And the Hunger Games are beginning. Yes, will she survive? Well, you know what's going to happen there. Now, my quibbles, I think Jennifer Lawrence is a little soft in the role. In the first-person narrative of the books, this is a much more harder-edged, she-will-survive-at-all-costs kind of person. But yet, I just think Jennifer Lawrence is wonderful to look at and watch anyway, so that's okay. There is a tendency to want to film everything with the handheld camera, along with very tight, sometimes blurry close-ups. Now, I understand that's an attempt to sort of soften some of the violence that's coming on. But for those of you that do not like that handheld moving camera type effect, you may find that to be a bit of a problem in many of the scenes here. One last quibble and then I'll get out of here, which is Woody Harrelson as Haymitch. Now, Haymitch is the mentor of Katniss. This Haymitch also is considerably softened, made much more likable. And I'm not so sure that's a great idea because this is a character that has a trajectory throughout the three stories, and I'm not sure where Haymitch can go from here except become much more fun-loving and likable. Sorry about that. Didn't care for that characterization. But I will give it 3.5 stars.
You know, I was talking with someone the other day who hadn't heard of The Hunger Games, and I said, well, welcome back from Mars. You know, I don't see how you could not have at least heard something about this amazingly popular book series. However, I thought, a particularly entertaining book. I only read the first of the trilogy so far, and I'm looking forward to the other two, I should say. But I thought this movie was a pretty faithful adaptation. I know that Suzanne Collins played a part in the screenplay along with filmmaker Gary Ross, so I know she would want to stay very close to the story. They made some very minor changes that make sense, and they left out some interesting subplots, which, you know, you could have to do. But this is still a 2-hour-and-22-minute movie, and to me, it seemed a little long. It took its sweet time to get going, but once it got moving, then you really did get involved with this very intense and intriguing story about survival. It's sort of the ultimate TV reality show, but played out against this background where some socio-political themes and are played out. All those really take a backseat to the survival story. You root for the heroine. The all of the parts that relate to all of the 99% versus the 1% and all of these kinds of things that people are reading into it. I think they'd all kind of take a backseat to that and the rooting for young love to survive and to flourish. But I found it very entertaining. I think that Jennifer Lawrence was spot on in the role. There are times when I thought that the pace lagged a little bit, mm-hmm. but once it really got to roll, I thought it was a very well-made, very entertaining piece of pop culture. And for that, I'm going to give it 3.5 stars as well.
Now, we may not like to hear it said, but it certainly is there in the film. It's kids killing kids. There is that in the film that unfortunately makes it extremely relevant today. If there's going to be a subtext in this film, some kind of moral outlook or something, it may reside there. I didn't find too much of a overview of what this means, and maybe that's to the credit of the film. Maybe we don't need to have somebody saying what it really means. I think what we did not need, however, is a panel of commentators that we cut away to continually.
Yes.
Stanley Tucci is one. Commenting on the action, because the book is told in the first person, we didn't have that, and I thought that was a good idea. I was a little annoyed every time we cut back to the leering Stanley Tucci commentary. It looks like maybe that's going to continue, huh?
Yeah, I suspect so, because it's also kind of a commentary on pop culture as well, and so it's a scathing one at that, and rightly so.
But 13 and up shouldn't be any problem.
Mm-hmm. I thought they did a pretty interesting job of keeping it to PG-13, mm-hmm. given the kind of grisly elements in the book. And when I was reading it, I thought, how is this not going to be R? But when I saw it, you know, they toned down the violence a little bit to make it a little more palatable for the young people.
Yeah, and it's made perfectly clear that Katniss's achievements with the bow and arrow are in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I remember several weeks ago saying to myself, you know, archery is going to be all the rage these days. And then the Kansas City Star this morning, or was it USA Today? There's a whole section about movies about archery that are coming up, including a movie we're going to be talking about today, The Kevin.
I see.
More on that later.
Yes. Well, incidentally, there's a movie that's opening this week at the Screenland Crossroads Theater called Battle Royale, and it's a Japanese film from 2000, and it's good timing because I've never seen the film. However, its plot bears some very real similarities to The Hunger Games, so it's kind of a nice companion piece if you want to compare and contrast. And the film was supposedly Quentin Tarantino's favorite film of all time. So it could be an interesting viewing, Battle Royale, which I think is much more violent, perhaps, than what we see in the Hunger Games. But that's The Hunger Games, and it is rated PG-13, and John and I are giving it a 3.5 out of 5 stars. So I think that's a pretty positive endorsement. Now, I know that there were midnight screenings. So if you've seen this film and you want to comment on it, join in on the conversation, give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can send us a note at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. We really would like you to join in on the conversation and let us know what you think. And if you've not seen the film yet, but you've read the book and you want to touch base on that, just give us a call and let us know. And since you brought up Kevin and archery, let's go ahead and talk about a film that also opens today. It stars Tilda Swinton, and it's a very disturbing film called We Need to Talk About Kevin. Marie?
This film was in Kansas City last fall for the Kansas International Film Festival, and now it's back. Yes, archery starts out as being kind of a sideline in here, and then it comes something else. Tilda Swinton was nominated for several awards for her performance as the mother in this film, and I don't know why she is motionless in this film. It's adapted from a novel, and it's a story about a couple who marry slightly later in life, maybe in their late 30s, and then decide to have children. The first child is a son. He seems to be rather quiet, intelligent, and the audience will notice through the child actor that there's something wrong here. And the boy is probably about 7 or 8 years old, and then the family has a little daughter, and that's when the problems start. There's sibling rivalry, except It's more rivalry. It's more like really intent to do harm. And it's about this time that you want to say, take that kid to a doctor or something, and it just doesn't happen.
Or the woodshed.
Yes, and there's a lot of, well, I don't think that would do any good here, John. There's a lot of denial that goes on in this film. And then later on, when the boy is a teenager, then the problems really start. And I won't give anything away by saying that there is a massacre at the school, and we know who's going to be involved in this. And the story is kind of told through flashbacks a little bit. She gets a call at work about what's going on, and then we kind of flash back as to the childhood years and everything. John C. Reilly plays a father, and I think that he has more emotion in his face than Tilda Swinton did. I haven't read the book, but I thought it was a disjointed film. I didn't think that her acting did anything to promote the character of the mother, and I'm only going to give it a 2.
Yeah, Tilda Swinton is capable of roles in which she shows a parental passion. I'm trying to remember the title of the one where she's defending her son. It's something about water, water.
Deep blue or something like that?
Yeah, and she goes all out to defend her son from a charge of murder. In this film, she is cold and kind of grim, and you're not sure, at least I was not, if part of the point here is of a parental detachment from her son that's part of the problem, or if it's a bad seed type situation, which I tend to think it was. I mean, what can you do about this kid seems to be what the movie's saying. It's very, very stylized. Lots of flash cuts, flashbacks, some flash forwards, and the first maybe 20, 25 minutes can be off-putting, but stay with it because all of those pieces will gradually coalesce into a coherent storyline. I think the film was unnecessarily stylized in that regard. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. This is a movie that when I was watching it, I was thinking that this was edginess for edginess' sake and that it didn't really necessarily serve the story so much because you do have the kind of quirky, eccentric filming styles plus the music choices.
And slashes of red.
Yes. Yeah. And things that made me think, yeah, they're doing this to kind of show that, hey, we're being really artsy and that it wasn't really necessarily serving the story. Tilda Swinton's performance, though, I kind of disagree with you. I thought she was right on the mark because she's shell-shocked, and that's what was coming through in her performance to me. Even in the early scenes where she's trying to cope with this child, she's at her wit's end because she doesn't know what to do. And, of course, it's the old nature versus nurture argument. Is this kid going off the deep end because he was just born that way? Is he inherently evil? Or is this something that the parents could have done? Was there something that she should have done as a parent to try to steer his path so that he doesn't become this psychopathic killer that he ultimately becomes? And I'm not giving anything away because that's all given away in the trailer, that he goes on a Columbine-style killing spree. Most of the movie is told in flashback as we go back to these scenes. The point is that I don't think anybody knows what the answer is. And so basically this movie is shrugging its shoulders.
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of parents out there watching this film who will also say, what happened? We don't know what happened. We don't know why what happened happened.
And the, you know? Yes, in one of the very latest scenes where she's talking to her son in prison, asking him why he did it. Well, you know, it's kind of up in the air. I'm not going to give it away, but it kind of sums everything
strange
up.
Strange scene.
It is a strange scene. It's a strange movie. So let's talk about numbers now. Marie, you gave it a 2. How about you, John?
I'll give it a grudging 3 because of the artistry of the film, which may or may not be too artificial.
I agree. I'm going to give it a 3 as well, only because I thought Tilda Swinton was riveting and worth watching.
I'm just going to backtrack for a minute to Hunger Games. Did you guys give your ratings?
Yeah, we gave it a 3.5 overall.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's We Need to Talk About Kevin, rated R, and it definitely earns that R rating. Let's talk about another one that we've all three seen. It's called Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Sweet film. Unexpected. It's a sketch. It's almost like reading one of those open-ended stories. It's all character and a few events, and then you're sort of, it's time to go now. But it's really quite a lovely movie. You have two brothers, a Mutt and Jeff type characterization here. Jason Segel is the title character. Susan Sarandon is their mom. She has her own story to tell here. She has some interesting encounters in the workplace, in her cubicle. What a workplace this is. Everybody is covered by the walls of cubicles. So she's dealing with that. And you have these two kids. Well, they're young men. Jeff, in particular, has this obsession with the name Kevin. Because, you see, Jeff thinks that everything that happens is a sign of something significant. And all of these signs eventually will come together to form a kind of meaning, which, in a way, they sort of do, involving an accident on top of a high bridge. But in the meantime, how these brothers kind of come together is very sweet, and how Susan Sarandon achieves a meaningful connection with love, and I won't disclose what that's all about either. There's a lot about this film. You just have to take it in as it goes. Let it work on you. Let it be a film about relationships. Don't really expect a very linear or coherent storyline, but savor it for its touches. I'm giving it 3.5.
You know, it poses the age-old question, does everything happen for a reason?
Mm-hmm.
Does it answer that question? That's kind of up to the audience to determine for themselves. Jay and Mark Duplass, who are the brothers that wrote and directed this film, and I use the word wrote you know, kind of loosely because, indeed, it's, the film was mostly improvised from what I understand. But they are the same guys that gave us a very quirky film called Cyrus. And
John C. Reilly, was it?
That John C. Reilly starred in, correct. And this is another very quirky, interesting, sweet-hearted movie.
Yeah.
It does earn its R rating because it's edgy. But these are characters that are kind of interesting. It's about sibling rivalry, and so this is something the Duplass brothers apparently know a little something about. And it's also set in their hometown of somewhere in southern Louisiana. It's the themes that I think that pretty much everyone can relate to, even if you don't have close siblings. I think anyone who grew up in a family with more than one person will at least have some connection with this movie. My only regret is that it seemed to me that the movie never really coalesced in the way I hoped it would.
Mm-hmm.
It does pose some interesting questions, but again, a little bit like Kevin, we need to talk about Kevin. There's a shrug in the movie as well.
Do we take our cue from Jeff or not? Because Jeff says everything that happens kind of has a meaning and connects up. Well, does everything that happens in the film cohere towards a central meaning and connect up? I think we're left wondering about that as much as we are left wondering about Jeff's own ideas about life and love.
Right. Marie?
Oh, I like this film. I think this may be the best film of the week for me. It's a warm film, even with the R rating, and that's for language because we have sibling rivalry. Jason Segel plays Jeff, and Jason Segel is a tall actor. He looks like a big teddy bear in this role. He doesn't shave for about 3 days, and he wears basically the same clothes. He kind of ambles through life, lives in the basement apartment of his mother's house. And Ed Helms plays his brother, and when they talk, Helms is the kinetic action person. He buzzes around the other guy like a fly going around a bear. And then they either agree or they disagree, you know, the various problems, and it's amusing to watch them. As we go through the day with the Kevin situation, as John said, and so the Jason Segel doesn't break character as near as I could tell. He has the same expression on his face, and I kept watching him. The camera rests on him, and he doesn't break it. He really carries through this. And Susan Sarandon, looking as good as I've ever seen her, has a situation in her office. And also Ray Don Chong is in the film, and I didn't recognize her. I thought this was really good. It was set in Shreveport, Louisiana. They make a great deal of bridges and the water, and there's a section where there's a rescue, and they jump in and rescue someone. And it just kind of ambles through the day. I really liked the way it was, and it's probably greatly improvised, but it just kind of hung together very well, and I'm going to say 3.5.
Well, let me just conclude by saying, now that I think about it, I do believe in the signs philosophy, because here we are talking about a movie where a guy's obsessed with the name Kevin, and we just finished talking about a movie wondering what to do about Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all working together, Russ.
Can't be a coincidence,
yeah.
Can it?
And we'll have a caller named Kevin.
That's right.
Probably sometime soon.
I'm giving it a 3. You guys are both giving it a 3.5. So we'll go ahead and average it out to a 3.5 for Jeff, who lives at home, rated R. We got a call from Jeannie from Overland Park, who wants to ask us a question about Hunger Games. Welcome aboard.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Okay. Well, very
well.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering, and I'm one of those parents who live under a rock, and you guys talked about that. I hadn't heard of the Hunger Games, I'll be honest with you. So I heard the neighborhood kids talking about it, and my daughter told me I'm uncool. So I guess my question to you guys is, she hasn't read the book also, but her older friend, my daughter is 11, and her older friends want to go watch the movie, 12, 13-year-olds. Do you think I should let her go, or should I be cautious about something? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Does she know more about the book and the film than you do?
She just went off the air, so she was going to take her answer off the air.
I mean, this is crucial. If you've got a child that age, ask them, what do they know about the book? I'll guarantee you they know more than you do.
Yes.
In which case, shouldn't be a problem.
Well, the movie is violent, and I will say that. It's rated PG-13 for that very reason. It is, thematically, it's difficult because it's about kids killing kids. And so you have to make a determination of whether or not you think your child is ready to deal with that subject matter. It is, of course, science fiction, but there are, there's violence in the world, and so dealing with, youth violence is something that your children will ultimately have to deal with. So I think the question that you have to ask yourself is, are they ready to see it on screen?
I did not see the film, but I have a question to ask you. Is the violence of children killing children shown, or is it implied?
Well, it's a little of both. Although it's not graphic in its violence, as I was reading the book, I saw saying there's no way they can do this and keep it PG-13. But some of those scenes, you don't see a lot of blood, and there's not a lot of there's no grisly kinds of killings, but it's the sort of thing that's implied, and so people will know that these people are dying, and so it's intense in that regard. So you just have to decide as a parent as to whether or not you think this is the right subject matter for your kids. But just know that probably everybody else is seeing it anyway. So you may want to consider
that as
well.
They'll see it.
They'll see it.
They'll see it.
And they'll sneak into the theater even if they're, not with a parent.
If you're a parent asking a question like that and you don't know about the books, then that's a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
You better know about the books.
Before we take a break, let's very, very quickly talk about a movie that opened on the 16th. Just give us a quick rundown of your take on 21 Jump Street, John.
The first 25 minutes or so, I just loved it. It was kind of crude humor, but it was hilarious. And you have these two guys teaming up to be the local cops on bikes. That's their first job. They've been boyhood friends and enemies alternately. Now here they are out of the police academy, and their first assignment is a disaster, so they're assigned to this school to track down some drug pushers there. What's most funny about it was the fact that here they are, coming out of high school in 2005, now going back to a high school as adults, disguised as teenagers in 2012, and discovering that what was cool in 2005 no longer is cool in 2012. There's some delicious contrasts there. Now the kids are concerned with ecology and study habits. I'm not sure what high school that was, but at any rate, that's the idea, and that contrast is delicious. But then the movie just jumps off a cliff. The last hour plus is just not funny, doesn't make sense, loses its way, etc. One star, maybe.
Marie?
I'd give it 1.5, and it's pleasing to know that Channing Tatum can actually do comedy. He should do more of it. And Jonah Hill does very, very well also in the active role. And I dare you to find Johnny Depp. He does make a cameo role in here.
And he's not listed anywhere.
He's not listed, but I dare you to find him.
Which is the funniest part of the movie far as I was concerned.
Yes.
I found it kind of tired and forced. Many funny moments, but they were really spread out over a very long, seemed to me like a long movie. Let's average it out to a 2. Is anyone that good? Okay, that's 2 for 21 Jump Street rated R. We're going to be taking a break now. We want to encourage you to give us a call and join in on the conversation at 816-235-2000. 2888 or send us a note at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. You can talk about The Hunger Games or any of the other movies that we're going to be talking about or anything else that's on your mind. So give us a call, and we'll be back in just a little bit. And welcome back to the Walt Boudin Show. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined by my fellow film critics, Marie Asner and John Tibbetts, talking about movies that have opened over the last 3 weeks here in the Kansas City metro area. We want you to join in on the conversation at 816-235-2888 or to send us a note at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. Another way you can communicate with us is via Facebook. And speaking of Facebook, we had a posting by Courtney who said, "John Carter was awful, and I'm a huge fantasy geek. Hunger Games missed some opportunities, but overall, it was worth the midnight showing." Thank you, Courtney, for posting that. If you have any feedback you'd like to give us, you can contact us as well. We do have a few announcements before we get on and talk about some of the other movies that are going on, but we know we had a personal one from John. What's going on, John?
Well, we've talked about my new book, The Gothic Imagination, in bookstores now before, but I'm glad to know that it has received a nomination for the year's Bram Stoker Prize. It's one of six nominees, and I'm going to be going out to Salt Lake City at the end of the week to attend the World Horror Convention. I'm a member of the Horror Writers group, and so we'll see what happens, but it'll be a neat chance to meet lots of other people in the field, and maybe I'll come away with a prize. We'll see.
Congratulations.
You all know who Bram Stoker was, Marie?
Dracula.
Da, 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 da.
Okay. Okay, and Marie, you had an announcement for us as well, right?
Yes. This is about Real Dialogue, Real, R-E-E-L. It's Bridging Culture Through the Film Series with Avila College and Missouri Arts Council. And it's going to be held at the Glenwood Red Bridge starting with March 24th. And I understand this is going to be a series of films, probably every Saturday at 10 a.m. Free admission with the Avila University ID card or Fine Arts Film League members. The film on the 24th is called The Learning, and it's about Filipino teachers who come to Baltimore during the school year, and there's culture clash for them. And so you can get more information by calling 913-642-4404. And then the second thing I have, I was walking by the Glenwood Theater, and I saw a poster for the Chinese Film Festival, and I thought it was starting also tomorrow. And if someone from the Fine Arts Theater could call in and verify that information, I think your series also goes on for about 4 or 6 weeks. And that's my announcements.
And incidentally, that screening of The Learning will be at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning at the Glenwood at Red Bridge. There are a few happenings at the Tivoli Theater we wanted to tell you about. On April 3rd at the Tivoli, there are two documentaries. One's called In Search of Haydn, and the other is Leonardo Live. And director Phil Grabsky will be in person for both of those shows. I know that the In Search of Haydn is playing more often this week. However, if you want to see the director and participate in a Q&A, he will be there on April 3rd at the Tivoli. And also at the Tivoli, their performing arts series continues with the Royal Ballet of London's performance of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, which will be Wednesday, March 28th at 1:30. They also have the Bolshoi Ballet's version of Esmeralda, which will be Wednesday, April 4th at 1:30, Thursday, April 10th at 6:30. And they also have the National Theatre Live's performance of Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer, which will be Wednesday, April 11th at 1:30 and Sunday, April 15th at 1:30, and the Royal Opera version of Rigoletto, April 18th and 28th. You can find more information about all of these activities at tivolikc.com. And also at the Screenland Crossroads, I brought it up a little bit earlier, Battle Royale, which is a grisly Japanese cult film from 2000, which Quentin Tarantino says is his favorite film of all time, and it bears more than a passing resemblance to the themes in The Hunger Games. And that's playing at the Screenland Crossroads at 17th and Washington. Also, Cinema KC, 6 p.m. Saturdays on KSMO TV 62. That's local Kansas City filmmakers showcasing their short films, and those it's playing regularly on Saturdays at 6 p.m. And finally, Planet Comic-Con is this weekend at the Overland Park Trade Center. Such stars as Edward James Olmos, Billy Dee Williams from the Star Star Wars films. Jake Lloyd, who played Anakin Skywalker in The Phantom Menace, will be there, as well as Gil Gerard and Aaron Gray from Buck Rogers. All of these stars will be appearing at Planet Comic-Con this weekend at the Overland Park Trade Center, as will Blair Butler, the daughter of local film critic Robert Butler. Blair is a TV personality who's an expert on comics, as well as a comic author herself. And Blair will be there at Planet Comic-Con, give you a chance to meet a Kansas City native who has gone on to bigger and better things at Planet Comic-Con. All right. So moving on, let's... We got a Facebook posting about John Carter, so I think it's good that we jump in now and talk about this movie. I tell you what, as a fan of Edgar Rice Burroughs, as a fan of fantasy, I was so looking forward to this film. It's a huge budget Disney operation. It's one of those ones they've really thrown all of their weight behind, and I saw in the trades yesterday that they expect it to lose $200 million. Ouch. Tell us a little bit about John Carter. I know that you're a Burroughs fan yourself, John.
Yeah, I've been in mourning for the past few weeks. I had gone out to see to the Disney Studios to see an advanced screening of it with a bunch of Edgar Rice Burroughs people like me. And in general, we liked it, although noting some obvious problems in the plot. But I'll tell you, the real problem with this film is with Disney. For every step forward, they took two steps back with this picture. The way it was presented, the way it was previewed, problems with the interference with what Andrew Stanton wanted to do, ranging from the title to other things. Disney seemed willing to spend $250 million, but then turned around and has seemed to do everything it could to impede the film's presentation and subsequent box office take. When you expect a film to make $600 million, my response is, are you out of your mind? I don't care if you're making a film about the second coming of Christ. To expect $600 million, therefore even $200 million is a failure, which is what the film is about this time worldwide. Yeah, there are problems, unfortunately, but a fantasy geek of all people. I hope this is not a fantasy geek who thinks that science romance swashbucklers started with Star Wars, because Star Wars, Avatar, Superman, they've all ripped off Edgar Rice Burroughs' Martian books for years. So it's the other way around. Who is ripping off whom? I like Taylor Kitsch and Lynn Collins as John Carter and Deja Thoris. I like the production values. It's in that darn plot that's going to confuse people. But one last word from me. If you complain about the plot being confused in John Carter, where were you when all of those Pirates of the Caribbean films came out? Where were you
of
the Harry Potter films came out? By goodness, John Carter is a model of linear storytelling compared to that stuff. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars.
Marie?
Good point, John. I was waiting a long time for John Carter, and I stand alone. I really like this film, and I don't care about the budget all those comments up there. I thought Taylor Kitsch, who I was not familiar with, does a very adequate job as John Carter. This is a story, I looked at it as anti-war. It's about a man who is forced to fight in a Confederate war. We told in flashbacks, he comes home to his family. There's a deep tragedy there, and he goes on by himself. He finds a cave that's got gold in it. He goes to tell somebody about it, and he ends up back in the army again. And so then all of a sudden there's a mysterious something that happens between he and his captain. I won't give anything away. And we find there's time travel. And it's explained as we follow through the film about the time travel, and I didn't object to this at all.
Space travel. Time travel?
Well, okay, space travel, time travel. Don't quibble. We've got only a few minutes here. Quibble after the show. And he lands on Mars, and then we have intentional humor because his body structure is different. And, you know, he's got these gigantic leaps, and it's played for humor. And he meets the people there and find out that there are aliens there that are fighting their own war. And once again, he's right in the middle of it. I waited for years and years to find out how anybody would ever do the great white apes, and I was satisfied with that.
It's a good scene.
Yes, and I could figure out about the flying machines looking like big dragonflies because of the atmosphere, and I just kind of followed it along that way. To me, it made sense, and I'm going to give this 3.5. Oh, it's a lovely soundtrack, too.
You know what? This film looked great. I have to say that the visuals were spectacular.
And see it in 2D. It's brighter. It looks better.
That makes sense. I did see it in 3D, and I was not disappointed in the way the movie looked. But we do have an interesting comment from Matt in Overland Park, who writes in and says about John Carter, "I went in with low expectations, so I wasn't disappointed. But I came out thinking that it wasn't the right director for the project. He wanted a way more spectacle on screen than was necessary. He couldn't stage a fight scene worth a darn." And I think he may have a good point there. You know, this Andrew Stanton is a terrific director who knows visuals. He's directed Finding Nemo, and he also directed Wall-E. So this is a animation director who's taking his first leap into the live-action sector. And I wonder, did he make a mistake by just calling it John Carter and not John Carter of Mars?
Well, check with Mitch Bryan on that. We were talking earlier, and he seems to think that it was to be John Carter of Mars, but Disney is scared of the word Mars.
Because so many Mars films have failed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd heard that too, yes.
But I thought that the film is getting a bad rap. It's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a decent spectacle. It's entertaining enough. It is just disappointing only if you, as Matt points out, if you go in with high expectations.
If you could have brought it in at $100 million, it would be a success. $250 million? I know I'm harping on this, but why budget it at such an exorbitant price when you know it could never make back what it has to be a success?
Yeah, you're probably right about that. So let's average it out to 3 for John Carter, rated PG-13. And we have... on the phone, Brian from the Glenwood is going to clear us up about the Chinese Film Festival. Hi, Brian.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It does start this Saturday, the next three Saturdays. We got three Chinese films for the Q&A following it. It's at 10 o'clock. It's a free festival. They do ask for a donation if people want to help support the KU's putting this on. So it starts tomorrow morning.
What time?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
And what are
which theater?
Mm-hmm. Oh, at the Glenwood Arts at Metcalf South.
Okay.
And down the road, a local filmmaker you all know, Benjamin Mead, we're going to be starting a monthly series the third Thursday of the month at 7:30. We're going to start off with his film in April with I woke up this morning in the Arkansas Delta.
All right. And can you tell us a little bit about the Chinese films that are going to be playing? What are you going to be seeing there?
Well, the Happy Times is tomorrow, followed by Piano in a Factory, and then it ends with Aftershock.
What can you tell us about them? Are they comedies? Are they action films? Or?
You know, if you go to, KU's putting this on, I should know, but I've not seen any of these films.
So, I think one of them
is But they
is
are
Zhang
on
Yimou.
Our website, and they're also on the KU's website.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Brian. Appreciate
Thanks, Brian.
You straightening
okay.
us out on that.
Uh-huh.
All righty. I wanted to talk about a film that... is currently playing at the Screenland, and it's called Corman's World. And Corman's World is about the infamous Roger Corman, who is often called the King of the Bees, a man who is self-taught in filmmaking. He just went out there and decided he was going to make movies back in the 1950s. And he started making these low-budget horror flicks and has progressed over the years and continues to produce movies that some people would dismissively call drive-in fodder or grindhouse movies. But he's managed to make some really terrific movies over the years as well. He's had a very interesting career, and this movie is an entertaining look at what he has done in his career. It also features many of the great filmmakers of today that he wound up mentoring. So you'll see talking heads including Ron Howard and Martin Scorsese.
Joe Dante.
And Joe Dante. And a lot of the people who he really helped to move along in their careers and actors as well. Interestingly enough, probably maybe the most interesting part of this movie is Jack Nicholson. Because Jack Nicholson... as you may know, does not grant interviews. He does not do anything on camera particularly. And he acquiesced, because Roger Corman was his mentor and the guy responsible for much of his early career and that kept him going during those lean years, and that was Roger Corman. And Jack gives some funny background stories into his relationship with Roger Corman, as well as some touching moments when he shows his genuine affection for this man who had such a great impact on his life. And there's a scene late in the film where he finally has to cover his eyes because he becomes overwhelmed with emotion talking about this man who meant so much to him.
Indeed, you're going to come away with a new respect for Corman, in case you didn't have one already, because of films like The Intruder. I predict you will come away from this film wanting to go check out The Intruder, which is around 1960, written by Charles Beaumont, starring a young William Shatner as a very hateful, racist bigot.
I remember
it's an astonishing film, shot on the low budget with Corman directing. They shot it in a small southern town, literally had to escape under cover of darkness when the townspeople found out what they were doing. One of the most important films to come out of that period about race relations, or lack of them.
Yeah, and I'm giving the movie a 3 overall. I think it's going to be more for film buffs than the general audience, but I found it very entertaining. And speaking of Roger Corman, Corman's films are going to be the subject of the upcoming Up to Date. The DVD gurus will guide us through the career of Roger Corman, who made 400 movies that never lost a dime. I will say, though, however, as pointed out in the documentary, they do think that the one film, his best film, The Intruder, is probably one that did lose money. The only one that they ever lost
Wouldn't
any money
you know?
On.
Yeah,
and newly available, incidentally, on DVD.
Yeah, and William Shatner plays the bigot. It's very interesting subject matter. Most of Corman's films were Edgar Allan Poe, or they were, science fiction, horror, all of the kinds of things that would be considered grindhouse movies back in the day.
He even made something about Kevin, I think.
Guilty Pleasures. Oh, yes.
And so stick around for Up to Date coming up next, where the DVD girls will be talking about all those titles. And on Facebook, Ben writes, on the woman who was asking about letting her 11-year-old see Hunger Games, I'd answer yes, but you as a parent should go with her to help her process what she sees. It's a story that has several important themes about our society that go beyond the violence. In fact, I'd argue that one of the problems that movie patrons face is parents who can't be bothered to help their children sit through what they're seeing on the screen, or how to behave in a theater, and just drop them off in little packs to roam unguided through the multiplex.
Very good.
That's true. True enough. So I would agree with you. If you're going to take a young child, I would say go with them and talk to them about the themes of violence that are taking place on screen. All right, let's move around. Now let's talk about a movie that opened back on March 9th. Marie, you were the only one. You took a bullet for us on this one, I think. It's a comedy with Eddie Murphy called 1,000 Words.
The film is about an hour and 45 minutes, and I would say about 35 minutes of it is quite good, actually. And part of that is a conversation that Eddie Murphy has with his mother, played by the late Ruby Dee. And as soon as she came on camera, I wondered, when was this film actually made? It was made 4 years ago. It's been sitting on a shelf waiting to be released now. She has dementia, and he goes to visit her. And this is so well acted. It's so intimate. The dialogue is so good. The rest of the film is not. Cliff Curtis, who always is an action figure, plays a guru who wants a book published, and Eddie Murphy is a book agent. He says, okay, I'll go ahead and publish this book, but he doesn't have any, he's not going to. And so Curtis has this tree magically come up in Eddie Murphy's yard, and as the leaves fall, as he talks, and so he has to keep quiet, and that's the premise. It's much padded through the rest of the film, and they repeat themselves, and there's one coffee manufacturer, whose name I won't say, who is product endorsed all the way through, probably financed this film, I'm guessing, and that spoils it. Everywhere you go, you see this. So I'm going to give it 1.5 for that 35 minutes that I really liked.
Ouch, that's 1,000 words, rated PG-13. Remember, you're listening to The Walt Bodine Show here on KCUR, and you can give us a call at 816-235-2888. Or you can send us a note at waltbodineshow@kcur.org to join in on the conversation. Let's quickly talk about a bizarre horror film that opened back on March 9th called Silent House.
Loved it. Loved it. Elizabeth Olsen, she's revisiting a house of her youth with her brother and uncle. With her brother and uncle. And it's a ghost story. But it's a ghost story that goes beyond just being a series of shocks and hauntings and all of that, because there is a backstory involving her that is revealed as the film progresses. It's shot in a semblance of real time, although obviously there's going to be some some joins here, but the effect is of one long uncut shot, which I think is probably pretty effective overall, as in real time you experience with her what's going on in the house. And it's not so much what is going on in the house, it's what was going on in the house that becomes distinctly disturbing. So I guess you can't say you love or like the film, but you respect the film for how it follows through on the time-honored setup of a haunted house or old dark house setting. So I'm going to give it 4.
Marie?
Well, I certainly did not like it as well as you did, John, and I do not care for the actress's performance. Elizabeth Olsen reminds me very much of Miley Cyrus. She's got smoky eyes, and she's got kind of a hoarse voice for a young woman. And she reacts to things, but she doesn't instigate things. And so if the door slams and your eyes pop and the camera catches her, you know, okay, she's acting. Well, no, that's a reaction to something. And so we have whatever this is, 89 minutes of reacting to this story. I didn't like that. I thought it was dragged on. And I think another actress probably would have done a better job with this film. And I'm going to give it 1.5.
Oddly enough, I'm not so sure it makes a difference who the actress is.
Maybe.
In this.
We got a reaction from something that you said, Marie. Cynthia in Prairie Village called in with a correction. Ruby Dee is alive and well at 86. It was her husband who passed
away. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. What does that current say? My bad.
You know, when it comes to Silent House, it's supposedly done in one long tracking shot, which has been debunked since then. So I did find the handheld camera work got a little old after a while, the shakiness. And I would think somebody just set the darn camera down for 1 minute so we can catch our breath. but I thought that it was overall clever and well acted. So I'll give it a 3. So I'll average that one out to a 3 for Silent House, rated R. And it does earn that R rating because it gets grisly. Let's also talk very quickly about W.E. Now, this is a film that was directed by Madonna and co-written by Madonna. She apparently had spent a lot of time watching her ex-husband Guy Ritchie directing films and decided that she wanted to have a try at it. And you know what? This is a very beautiful film to look at. This is a story that has two parallel storylines, one taking place in the 90s and one taking place in the 30s and 40s. And it's all about the romance between the Duke of Windsor and Wallace Simpson. And the more contemporary story is about a woman who's obsessed with that story. We see two stories about wealthy women who have bad marriages and wealthy women who are abused and all of the how they apparently attempt to overcome this. The movie really trips up in when it tries to intersect the stories in some way. There's very awkward moments where those two characters interact and it becomes laughably ridiculous. And some of the dialogue is bad. It looks good, well acted, but ultimately empty. So I'm going to give W.E. 2. Did anyone else see that one? Yeah. So I'm giving W.E. rated R 2. And In Darkness is a movie that is about a situation in World War II when a number of Jewish people held up in the sewers in Poland during the Nazi occupation. And it's a film that was done by Agnieszka Holland, who is a very acclaimed filmmaker of Europa, Europa, and a number of other quality films, beautifully produced. And it's a movie that serves, I think, as a stirring tribute to those people who endured great hardships during this time. It's a very workmanlike film, good, pretty in the sense that it's very well filmed. But I don't think it ever quite succeeded in allowing us to understand the characters. There wasn't enough character development, I felt. And this sort of Schindler's List of the sewers, this one particular gentleman who is trying to help them, his character is completely underdeveloped. And that was, I think, one of the tragic mistakes that this movie made. Good overall, but I think in the final analysis, I'm only going to be able to give In Darkness a 3, and that's rated R.
Russ, is it subtitled?
It is.
Mm-hmm. In fact, she insisted on performing it in Polish.
Okay.
And let's talk quickly about another film that opened back on March 16th called Thin Ice. John?
Which I like very much. As much as anything, because of Greg Kinnear in the role, he's an insurance hustler, and he sees an opportunity to pull a con Well, guess who gets conned? That's all I'll say in that regard. But in the meantime, you watch what he's trying to do just fall apart at the seams. This scheme of his just is destined to go nowhere. And with each impediment, with each obstacle, you watch Greg Kinnear's face registering, oh my gosh, is this really happening to me? And at times you just see a reaction shot of him, mouth hanging slack open, eyes dismayed, and it's funny. Kinnear is absolutely perfect for a role like this, this woebegone guy doing his best to salvage what is an impossible scheme. And it's beautifully crafted film. You may want to watch it twice. It's one of those kinds of films. But in the meantime, don't necessarily take for granted what you're seeing. And he tells you that at the very beginning of the film. Certainly 3.5. I'm veering towards 4, but I'll give it 3.5.
Anne Marie?
Oh, it's a good film. And Greg Kinnear's face, yes, at the beginning of the film, he's all sweetness and light, and by the end of the film, his face is about 14 inches long. I mean, you can just see everything that he's planned go astray. It borrows very much from Fargo as far as the locale, which was in Wisconsin in the winter.
Kenosha.
And also the matter of disposing of certain things without giving anything away is very much like Fargo, and his performance is like William H. Macy. I'm going to say a rating of 3.
All right, so we'll average that out to a 3 for Thin Ice, rated R. You've been listening to The Walt Bodine Show here on KCUR. And to find our archives and subscribe to The Walt Bodine Show podcast, visit kcur.org. Our show was produced today by Andrea Salenzi. Our announcer is Michael Byers. And thanks to my fellow film critics today, I'm Russ Simmons. This is The Walt Bodine Show, and enjoy your day.